Remember, O Lord, what thou hast wrought in us, and not what we deserve. As thou hast called us to thy service, make us worthy of our calling, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Along with Mike Keep, I'm pleased to be using this pulpit again, this furniture, very much a fruit of the Reformation, which reminds us of our history and our emphases. A month or two ago, Elaine had to call me out of the pulpit because I wasn't being heard. So I hope you can all hear tonight, despite certain weaknesses of voice at the moment and the usefulness of water. In some churches there's a lot of ministers saying, "The Lord be with you," and congregation saying, "And also with you." And this goes on more than once in some services, almost becomes a bit tedious. And on one occasion, the minister in a church, you probably read this one, said, "There's something wrong with this microphone." The whole congregation replied, "And also with you." See how dangerous microphones can be. Well, we're into chapter 14 tonight. Having looked at 13 this morning, we were out in the big world coping with rulers and governors and authority. And if you want to know any more about chapter 13, ask Lynn, because they were on the same chapter in Cordwell. We've caught up with one another, it seems. But now we're back really in the churches when we reach chapter 14. Anyone going to Cordwell next Sunday morning might get a slightly improved version of what you hear tonight. Practice makes perfect, they say. But Paul had never been to Rome. He'd never met in Rome, on site, any of the people he's writing to in this chapter, which reminds us of how easily information, dare I say gossip, moved across the Roman world, as easily as it does through Derby Diocese, for example. And what Paul heard about were that there were distinctly two different classes of people in the church at Rome. The weak and the strong. And it's quite possible the weak thought they were the strong, but Paul, who thought he was certainly strong, recognised certain people as weak, and other fellow members of the Christian church as strong. At the very beginning of the chapter we shall be looking at next Sunday night, chapter 15, verse 1. "We who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak, and not to please ourselves." We, you see, who are strong, "I'm strong," St. Paul was saying. Perhaps in the reflection he'd have looked back on his life and seen many situations in which, according to his definition, he'd been weak. But we needn't worry about that. At this stage in his spiritual journey, he saw himself as strong. And he defines these groups of people, saying at the beginning of chapter 14, "Accept him whose faith is weak, without passing judgment on disputable matters. One man's faith allows him to eat everything," the strong man this is, "but another man," this is the weak, "whose faith is weak, eats only vegetables." And this isn't as a result of his diet, incidentally. "The man who eats everything must not look down on him who does not. And the man who does not eat everything must not condemn the man who does, for God has accepted him. Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he stands or falls, and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. You can see very clearly through these verses certain characteristics of Christian people. We've already seen it there, haven't we, that they're people who God has accepted. It's what the early chapters of Paul's letter to the Romans are all about. How God accepts people because of what Jesus has done for them by his shedding of blood on the cross, so that they're justified freely by God's grace. They have peace with God through what he did at Calvary and access to God's grace. God has accepted him. That's what ought to be able to be said about any Christian. And you can move on, I won't pick them all out, but it's worth looking at one or two things. The man who's a Christian gives thanks to God. It's there in verse 8. The man who gives thanks to God, that's a Christian trait that we need to be coveting. He lives to the Lord, also dies to the Lord. He belongs to the Lord. As has already been stated, the Christian is God's servant. He belongs to him. And Christ died that he might return from death and be Lord of both the dead and the living. Verse 9. And so what place is it, if this is what a Christian is like and what his position is, for fellow Christians to be pronouncing judgment on one another? Because another aspect of the Christian is, as you can see in verse 12, each of us will give an account of himself to God. I'm picking out all these verses, at least some of them, that defines what a Christian is and how he should behave. We could go on in this way and take note of these statements that Paul makes about what Christians ought to be and how they ought to be understood, and therefore how they ought to be prized and welcomed and owned and loved. But I've given you some hints there. Now what about these weak and strong people? Well, let's just try and define them as Paul has defined them. The weak person eats only vegetables, abstains from meat, and also he observes certain days, probably many of them, as special days, regularly stepping aside from society and making his praise and devotion to God on particular religious feasts and days. This is how the weak man is shown, and we can go on to verse 21 if you like and note that he doesn't drink wine. It is better not to eat meat or drink wine or do anything else that will cause your brother to fall, because your weak brother avoids certain meat and drinks and doesn't drink alcoholic wine. And if you do these things, don't flaunt it over him and don't look down on him, because he doesn't do them and thinks it would be wrong of him to do them. And to perhaps tempt him from these things would be to put a stumbling block in his way. That's made very plain in all this, that we just must not do that and put temptation in someone's way who is weak. It is wrong for a man to eat anything that causes someone else to stumble. So for the strong man who can eat anything, who can drink wine, who doesn't keep certain days as special and different, for that man, great meat eater and perhaps drinks wine, we trust in moderation, he must not mock the person who doesn't, as Paul sees it, the weaker person, and make him do something that his conscience forbids him to do. It's as simple as that. What matters is faith, however weak, and strong faith mustn't destroy weak faith, and a brother who can be looked upon because of his practices as weak. Of course, a weak also owe respect to the strong and mustn't forever be watching them, seeing where they go after church on a Sunday into the Devonshire Arms or somewhere, and being critical and not liking what they do and complaining about them, and perhaps feeling a little bit better than the people who go there when they go straight back home and meditate on the hymns and the sermons and all they've been listening to. They're in danger of judging brothers. You see, you themselves must one day, as I've already mentioned, appear before the judgment seat of Christ. This is the problem of the weak. Perhaps maybe a touch of envy, they may be finding it difficult, but hopefully they don't often see the stronger brother enjoying roast beef and Yorkshire pudding and horseradish and all the rest of it, because you hope the stronger brother's enjoying his meal but not in front of the weak one. But if they do, again there'll be this temptation to judge and criticise and act as if the stronger man who eats beef with some vegetables, no doubt, and drinks and wine with his dinner, he mustn't be judged as less than Christian. Now, so it is a serious problem that was beginning to emerge from Rome, that you've got these two groups of people, weak and strong, and the one despising the other criticising the other, and this is very much going against the most precious gift anyone can have who's been accepted by God, faith, both faith that Christ has died for him, and faith, of course, that can even move mountains. And this would be producing a mountain of trouble. So faith was very important in this situation. That's the picture. And Paul is dealing with it here, as you could see, in giving them very good advice to consider their fellow Christians. And the one thing that the strong must not do is to destroy the weak, because the good must never destroy the better, and the strength must never make the weak weaker. This is the scene, this is the situation. Divers ways in receiving Christ and translating what they believe into how they behave. This is what these chapters of Paul to the Romans are all about: behaviour following belief. Remember, Romans 12 begins, therefore, in the light of belief that we have in the work of God in Jesus Christ, therefore it results in behaviour. Here's further examples of it in dealing with these two classes of people in the Church of Rome, giving them good, strong advice. The challenge to us, I think, tonight is this: how does church life in our country, for example, Derby Diocese, Mercia Deanery — I mustn't despise people who chose the title Mercia, even though I thought it was an amazing piece of self-exhibitionism when after all even Repton, which they should have kept as their name, only lasted a short time as the capital of Mercy passed on to Tamworth. We've been reminded of it recently with a new statue there. But how do we cope in all these areas of church, and not least in our own parish, in our own church, with this challenge? One of the problems is that so much of what Paul is speaking about here does not matter one iota to you or me. Eating, drinking, observing certain days are perhaps not the chief aspects of our life and occupy most of our minds. So how do we see what Paul is saying to these different classes of people in the first century AD, about 50 or 60 AD, something like that? How do we look at it in 2018? The word of caution is needed here. It was needed when I was studying the letter to the Romans as part of my training to come to places like this and preach. And when we got to this chapter, the lecturer made it very plain that Paul is not speaking about bands of hope, the temperance movement. That was a situation in particularly 19th, early 20th century England, for example, where large families, headed up by a father perhaps who had days of hard work, earning little, and then at the end of the day, the end of the week probably, use what little he'd earned in the local inn. And there wasn't much for perhaps, like my father's family, a family of 12 children, when the father had spent so much of the weekly wage in the local hostelry. No wonder the band of hope that would ask a child of 7, like my father, to sign the pledge never to touch alcohol. No wonder he readily signed the pledge and kept it till he died at nearly 87. Because his home experience, his memory, tarnished drink, and he'd seen the dangers of it. And of course we do have the problem of alcoholics who depend upon the support of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, what's said about drinking wine ceremonially in that ancient world doesn't apply to this situation. And I'd begin to suggest to you now, in the beginning of the 21st century, it won't apply also to the amount of vegetables in your diet, because we're told every day, every time you wake up and listen to the Today program or something like that, we've got to eat more vegetables. We're not eating nearly enough. And if the National Health Service is to manage on an even slightly enhanced budget in the next year, diet has to be taken extremely seriously. I've been trying hard to take a diabetic diet seriously for the last 37 years. And I pledged, you know, about 10, 20 years ago that come the age of 70 I'd be back on best butter instead of these olive spreads and the like. I said I would certainly make sure I had one chocolate a day, but this was a departure from the very strict regime I entered and kept from about 1981 into the 1990s anyway. But I don't think we're dealing therefore with vegetables in this situation and can look down on anyone who is more of a vegetarian today in the light of medical science and all the information we have. Now, I know somebody like Arthur Goodwin, late of Cordwell, well into his 90s, who doesn't believe one bit of climate change propaganda, would have no truck with not benefiting the farmers and denying themselves beef and pork and lamb and mutton, etc. But we do have to listen to what we hear and to what we're told. So we can't apply this teaching to this sort of thing. Where can we apply it in the life of the church today? What things are not that important that people attach enormous importance to? What divides a congregation? Well, before I stand down, I will tell you how much encouraged I was by the bishop who's looking after us at the present time, Rod Thomas, Bishop of Maidstone, when after not the last but the previous GAFCON conference he'd been on, made the observation in a paper he sent round that there can within a church congregation be good disagreement over certain issues. And he was really contrasting with the marriage of two people of the same sex, which doesn't really allow for much agreement at all. He was contrasting that situation with the use of women in ministry. And he said over marrying people of the same sex, there won't be much room for any disagreement at all. Over how we use people like Lynn, Carolyn, whoever in the ministry of the church, Bishop of Repton and all the rest of them, there is room for good disagreement, and we need to look out for this provision. And when I met him for the first time a week last Thursday, I began my conversation with saying how encouraged I'd been with his observation in that particular paper and how useful I thought it would be to a church like ours that has a church like Cordwell. You never know, perhaps one day we'll recover a church like Emmanuel, but that's not for broadcast outside this building, I think. But nonetheless, good disagreement over that sort of issue. And you can perhaps think of others that I've not thought of, but you can think of them. There's room for good disagreement, and I don't know where we'd put the weak and the strong. I wouldn't like to suggest that you can again do some homework and decide who are the strong. Am I the strong making much of the use of women on the first Easter morning? Or are they strong who make more of Genesis, the very beginning of time, and how it's interpreted concerning the role of woman to man? That's your homework. I'm not going to determine and give you the answer tonight. But it's been that sort of thing that's caused division in our church. It probably could have been illustrated with weak or strong. I'm not going to say who's which. And that needs such care when we think of how God looks on us as servants, children, whose grace has reached us, perhaps understood in different ways. We need to get priorities right and not let the whole church be divided into two classes over things where there can be good disagreement and completely diminish and prevent the growing mission of Christ's church. And next week I think we're to look at unity and mission. Some people would have looked at the unity a bit tonight in the next few verses. In any case, my time is very close to needing to finish, and so I will finish. And so next week we'll pick up a little bit more of this in the opening verses of chapter 15 and then go on from unity to mission. The two are very closely linked and very important.